It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Airbnb is a community-driven hospitality company which recently announced it will be offering accommodations to travelers to Cuba. It's just the latest example of the growing popularity of the sharing economy. From Uber to TaskRabbit, Robert Morris University economics professor Brian O'Rourke joins us to look at how this sharing economy is changing the way we live and do business. Brian O'Rourke, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks a lot, Paul. It's a pleasure as always.
Let's begin with the obvious. What is the sharing economy?
Well, unlike so many terms in economics, the sharing economy is actually what it says it is. It's people from all walks of life, from different parts of the world, in some cases, different parts of the country, sharing the things that they have with each other for a fee.
For a fee.
Oh, absolutely.
There's a catch.
Yeah. It's not like you're sharing with your cousin or your brother or anything like that. It's a way to make a little bit of money.
Is this something new or has it been around for a while?
Well, I was thinking about this. This term sharing economy just sort of has come up recently, but I remember growing up, we'd go to the beach and we'd live in somebody else's house for a week. So the idea of the sharing economy has actually been around for a really long time. Think of home rentals and even 10 or 15 years ago with a company like Napster, where we're sharing music. And of course, you know, the music industry got rather bent out of shape about that. But the idea of a sharing economy has actually been around for some time. But this taking off of the sharing economy, the expansion of the sharing economy to things like tools and meals and even clothes is much more of a recent phenomenon. We've seen it, I think, take off for three particular reasons. One, because of the Great Recession, people they lose their jobs, they're looking for ways to make some money, and they say, hey, well, you know, what if I just rent some of the stuff that I have? Another aspect of this has been just the internet itself, just the ability to find these things and to keep track of people. And from some indications, there has been sort of this turning of the millennial generation, sort of turning away from having things to more experiences. So it's great if I have this big flat screen TV, but I'd like to go see another part of the country, another part of the world. And so I can, instead of spending money on those things, maybe I go a little bit more minimalist in the house, and then, you know, I'll travel somewhere and stay in somebody else's house.
I think most people are familiar with Uber and Lyft as alternatives to taxis, but what else is shared?
Well, it's unbelievable what people will share with you, especially if you're willing to pay for it. You can just borrow somebody's car. So there are websites, Relay Rides and Get Around are two of them, where you make arrangements with someone, you show up at their house, they give you their car keys, and then you use their car for a fixed period of time or a day or a week, or just like going to Hertz, but it's working out of somebody's home. You mentioned TaskRabbit earlier. This is a place that will rent you pretty much any kind of a tool that you want. There are places that will rent services. There are places that will rent even clothes where you can, you know, try on things, just try different styles. There are places that you can, instead of going to the bank, you can go and use other people's money. So instead of borrowing from a local bank, you can borrow from a group of people who have pooled the resources who really aren't regulated by the banking sector. One of my favorites, at least I've never used it because they don't have it around here, but I'm hoping that they do because it just sounds so neat, is a company called Eat With, where someone will cook a meal for you in their house and they charge you a fee. And as long as your meal is unique, you can keep working with the Eat With folks.
And going back to TaskRabbit, the idea behind that would be that if you want to rent a chainsaw, which is something that you may not use again for several years, you don't have to buy it. You can just borrow it for a while for a fee.
Or you could borrow somebody who has the chainsaw, and they'll you know, it's almost a handyman kind of service as well.
So somebody who has a lot of tools can make some money loaning out stuff that way.
Absolutely.
It's Essential Pittsburgh, and we're addressing the sharing economy with Robert Morris University economics professor Brian O'Rourke. I would imagine that people would have concerns about having strangers in their cars or homes. How is that being addressed?
Well, one of the great advantages of having the internet is that you can sort of keep tabs on people. You can keep tabs on the host's So whether it's using somebody's home, whether it's as advertised or whether the car is as advertised, or you can keep track of people who are using things as well. eBay is one of those sites that has sort of perfected the idea of giving someone a thumbs up or a thumbs down, sort of a just a monitoring option. And as a result of that, there's a remarkable amount of trust in the transactions that take place. And if you just don't want to trust people, you just go and use you would use a Hertz or an Avis or something like that to rent a car. You go to a hotel instead of using Airbnb. And GPS is another wonderful contributor to the sharing economy because you can keep track of where things go. People have, you register your cell phone and there's that GPS chip in your cell phone and you just, hey, I know where they are. So some of that sort of angst and concern gets reduced because of the technologies that are available. You're always going to have a problem. Problems will pop up. There'll always be somebody who ends up trashing a house or trashing somebody's car. And so that leads to some of the issues of things like insurance. How do I insure something, my own car, if I'm giving it to someone else, if I'm letting them use it? Does my auto insurance cover that? If somebody gets in a wreck with my car,
it's a good question. What's the answer?
Well, the answer is it's being worked out. There are companies, private companies, who are coming into the market who are trying to provide that service as well, to try to provide an insurance service that may not be covered by that's State Farm or Progressive or one of those other companies may not cover those. You can get sort of this insurance rider through separate companies.
And we talked earlier about sharing goods and services, why people would want to do that. But tell us, Brian, what the upsides are for the economy. We know why individuals think this is a good idea, but from the standpoint of someone like yourself, who is an economist, what does this do for us overall in terms of helping give a boost to business in America?
Well, sort of from a more technical economic perspective, the sharing economy works to reduce transaction costs. So it helps to increase the number of beneficial trades by reducing the costs to the people who are participating in it. As you mentioned before, instead of having to buy a chainsaw, if I just need it for one job, I can use somebody else's chainsaw. So I don't have to go through the cost process of buying a saw or even hiring somebody to do the job for me. And that opens up some income for me to purchase other things. So, maybe I can rent the chainsaw for the afternoon and then go out for dinner for the evening.
You talk about an insurance issue, which might be good for the insurance companies, but you loan that out to somebody and God forbid something happens, then you're maybe going to go back at the guy that loaned you the chainsaw and say,
yeah, well, that's, I think, one of the reasons why the insurance side of this hasn't been solved quite yet, because there are who knows.
But clearly there's some opportunities here for the insurance companies.
Oh, certainly. Certainly. Yeah, there's money to be made, but insurance companies want to make sure that they're making money, not paying out too many claims on that kind of stuff. As far as other issues with the economy, though, it's amazing how many of these kinds of companies exist already. There's over 11,000 companies that are registered as sort of sharing types of companies. And if you look at a company like Airbnb or Lyft or Uber, the market valuation of those companies is in the tens of billions of dollars already. Some of them outpace companies like Hertz. They are worth more on paper, at least, than some of these other companies. So what are you going to do with all that revenue that's being created? They create new jobs. They create new aspects. They build new things to try to get people more involved in these kind of transactions. It increases competition for sure. And from an economist's perspective, this is great because increased competition lowers prices. It increases the amount of transactions or the number of transactions that take place. And we really like the looks of that. It also, these things really do a good job of reducing what we call asymmetric information. The more interactions that people have in these sharing economies, the more information is generated about the lenders and the borrowers of goods and services. And so we can get a better idea as to who we want to rent our homes to or who we want to rent our chainsaws to. If, I guess if they run out of limbs, we know we don't want to rent to them. But
probably not.
But we can get information about individuals, and that's a really important thing when it comes to economic transactions.
Provide us with some examples of the sharing economy taking place here in Pittsburgh.
Okay, so Lyft and Uber have run into some issues. The Pennsylvania
Utilities Commission.
Utilities Commission have not been big fans of Lyft or Uber. They've ordered them to stop operations. And I think on a formal level they have. There might be some people on the periphery who are trying to skirt that issue. But there are other places. Airbnb, for example, is doing fairly well in Pittsburgh. I just was on the Relay Rides website yesterday. I can rent a car from a Toyota Camry for about $25 a day up to Mercedes SUVs to $150 a day. I just got to show up and say, hey, give me your keys. So we have places like that that are operating in Pittsburgh, some of the bigger names operating in Pittsburgh, but I'm still holding out for the Eat With folks. I think there's some great cooks and chefs in Pittsburgh who operate out of it. I know there are these people because I've eaten at their homes and I haven't had to pay for that yet, but they're so good. I'm willing to pay for it. And I think they could do a really great business in Pittsburgh. And just with the variety around here, I think that would be a spectacular thing on the sharing economy in Pittsburgh.
Brian O'Rourke is a professor of economics at Robert Morris University and joins us regularly to look at the economy. Brian, thanks as always for being here. We appreciate it.
Well, I love coming down. Thanks a lot.
Coming up, how is the sharing economy being used in Pittsburgh?
Whether it's couch surfing or time banking or any other sharing economy or just, hanging out with some neighbors on your street and watching their kids or helping them out, grab something from a top shelf. That is what these things, these sharing economy systems are trying to do. It's to kind of get us back.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're continuing our look at the sharing economy by taking a sociological approach to the trend. What does the sharing economy tell us about possible changes in society and in the economy? Joining us to consider these questions is Dr. Kimberly Cressup, a visiting lecturer in the Department of Sociology at the University of Pittsburgh, who has a background studying subcultures and social movements both here in the United States and in Europe. Kim, thank you for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Great to be here.
What do you think enables the sharing economy to work? There are both social and economic factors, right?
Yes. So sociologists have found a number of reasons why people participate in the sharing, so-called sharing economy. One, of course, economic. It's cost-effective for consumers and creates earning opportunities for producers who are optimizing their assets, like renting out their cars or renting out their spare bedrooms or making money by selling things on Craigslist. Social reasons include both environmental, so people are concerned about reducing the impact on the environment by sharing a car, recycling goods, and social aspects like creating social networks or increasing their social connection by participating in things like neighborhood tool libraries or couch surfing with locals when they're traveling to unfamiliar places.
People use the term sharing economy to refer to a lot of things. How do you distinguish the different experiences or platforms contained under that umbrella term?
The term sharing economy refers to a diverse range of practices. So sociologists really look at two kinds of groups here. So the first one are practices that are based on social solidarity, environmentalism, and a commitment to open access. And these things are couch surfing, people staying at people's homes for free. Free cycling lets people exchange goods for free. Things like the East End Share Fair here in Pittsburgh, where people swap goods for goods instead of goods for money. And these exchanges are free, but they're also highly reciprocal. So couch surfing, for example, is the number one example used in social science research. And couch surfers take on the role of both hosts and guests in relatively equal numbers. So it's a very reciprocal kind of exchange. So these, I would say, are about sharing, what we consider sharing sociologically or anthropology. The other group is platforms where providers get some cash and consumers get a bargain. And this is something that sociologists call collaborative or sometimes connected consumption or consumerism, and connected referring, of course, to the digital aspects. And so this refers to well-funded for-profits like Airbnb or Uber, things like that. And so these are not necessarily completely driven by the feel-good values of environmentalism or the generous impulse that the word sharing kind of connotes. Not to say that the impulse isn't there, right? That this is sort of how those grew, or at least how they're talked about. But they are driven essentially by profits, not sharing in terms of reciprocity being the fundamental aspect.
What role do you think trust plays in the sharing economy?
Trust is the number one most studied aspect of the sharing economy by social researchers. So we talk about something called generalized trust. This is that we as members of society trust that other members of society are going to follow the rules, regulations, and norms of a society. So when we get in our car and we drive around town, we trust that other drivers are going to follow the rules of the road just as we are. And so social interactions like that are governed by a series of laws and regulations and norms, which provide some recourse if a risk doesn't pay off. But digital interactions are a little bit fuzzier. People aren't sure or don't know what the recourse is if the risk doesn't pay off. So I think this is why social researchers consistently find that reputation systems online are important for creating accountability in a way, so that users can vouch for one another through ratings or through reviews or by describing their experiences.
And do we have any reason to believe that people are more trusting now than in years past? Or have the ways that we develop trust, have they changed in the internet age?
It's not that trust has changed, but the mechanisms that help generate trust have changed. So historically, sharing was a community or kinship-based practice, and well-established social relationships were the basis for trust. If you did something to create distrust, then everyone in your community knew about it the same day. Mm. But reputation systems online, as I said, are designed to create accountability in a similar way. So people, you know, write reviews and ratings and so forth. Some studies suggest that this information might not be very reliable, but it is what people rely on when they are seeking out opportunities to share cars or houses or whatever the case may be.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we're talking with Dr. Kimberly Cressup, visiting lecturer at the Department of Sociology at the University of Pittsburgh, looking at the sharing economy. We might assume that people who use some of these sharing resources are trying to save money. Is that it, or are people looking for something else here?
Well, people are always trying to save money. People love bargains across the board. But people are definitely looking for convenience is the number one thing people are looking for here. And people are looking for unique experiences. So one of the most surprising findings, I think, in sociology about this is that users who are part of the sharing economy aren't sharing because they need to, but because they want to, because having a unique experience or an authentic, in quotation marks, experience is important to them.
Who tends to be the users of these sharing platforms? We would assume it's young people, right?
Yeah.
And if so, why is that?
Yes. Roughly half of users are 18 to 34 years old. It's roughly 50-50 between women and men, so gender doesn't seem to play a role here. Most participation happens in urban centers, also not surprising. But also, as I said, the surprising finding is that sharers are twice as likely as non-sharers to have incomes over $100,000. So again, it's not about needing these services, but about wanting unique or authentic experiences. And there is some research that suggests actually that older people over 35 or over 55, are not less trusting than younger people. They're actually more trusting. They have more life experience and so forth to draw on and feel they're better equipped to make decisions in potentially risky situations than young folks.
It seems like people view these different experiences in the sharing economy as an alternative or a way of rejecting something. So to paraphrase the famous Marlon Brando movie in the 50s, what are they rebelling against?
Yeah, well, again, this depends on what you're talking about. Certainly some people see using services like Uber or Airbnb as sticking it to the hotel industry or the rental car industry, right? But in fact, Airbnb is a $10 billion a year company. Uber is $40 billion a year. So they're not really sticking it to the corporations as much as they might like think they are. But again, it's a mixed bag. Things like couch surfing, for example, people might be having more meaningful interactions and meeting more different kinds of people. So people are rebelling against conformity, I would say, in sort of impersonal exchanges that they see through chains and so forth. But again,
they want something that has more accountability.
Maybe not accountability, but maybe more meaning. Something that stems from a more meaningful kind of social interaction, I think, is what people are looking for. And so, as I said, though, that's not always the case. That's the ideal. But in fact, most Uber passengers may not even speak to their driver, or Airbnb guests may never see their host, even though that's what they're hoping for.
Dr. Kimberly Cressip is a visiting lecturer in the Department of Sociology at the University of Pittsburgh, joining us to look at the sharing economy. Dr. Cressip, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Coming up, how is the sharing economy being used in Pittsburgh?
You know, I want to get out of the house. I want to hang out with my friends again, but there's poop on my shirt, and I don't want to buy a bunch of the new clothes.
More Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're continuing our look at the sharing economy by taking a sociological approach to the trend. What does the sharing economy tell us about possible changes in society and in the economy? Joining us to consider these questions is Dr. Kimberly Cressip, a visiting lecturer in the Department of Sociology at the University of Pittsburgh, who has a background studying subcultures and social movements both here in the United States and in Europe. Kim, thank you for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Great to be here.
What do you think enables the sharing economy to work? There are both social and economic factors, right?
Yes. So sociologists have found a number of reasons why people participate in the sharing, so-called sharing economy. One, of course, economic. It's cost-effective for consumers and creates earning opportunities for producers who are optimizing their assets, like renting out their cars or renting out their spare bedrooms or making money by selling things on Craigslist. Social reasons include both environmental, so people are concerned about reducing the impact on the environment by sharing a car, recycling goods, and social aspects like creating social networks or increasing their social connection by participating in things like neighborhood tool libraries or couch surfing with locals when they're traveling to unfamiliar places.
People use the term sharing economy to refer to a lot of things. How do you distinguish the different experiences or platforms contained under that umbrella term?
The term sharing economy refers to a diverse range of practices. So sociologists really look at two kinds of groups here. So the first one are practices that are based on social solidarity, environmentalism, and a commitment to open access. And these things are couch surfing, you know, people staying at people's homes for free. Free cycling lets people exchange goods for free. Things like the East End Share Fair here in Pittsburgh, where people swap goods for goods instead of goods for money. And these exchanges are free, but they're also highly reciprocal. So couch surfing, for example, is the number one example used in social science research. And couch surfers take on the role of both hosts and guests in relatively equal numbers. So it's a very reciprocal kind of exchange. So these, I would say, are about sharing, what we consider sharing sociologically or anthropology. The other group is platforms where providers get some cash and consumers get a bargain. And this is something that sociologists call collaborative or sometimes connected consumption or consumerism, and connected referring, of course, to the digital aspects. And so this refers to well-funded for-profits like Airbnb or Uber, things like that. And so these are not necessarily completely driven by the feel-good values of environmentalism or the generous impulse that the word sharing kind of connotes. Not to say that the impulse isn't there, right? That this is sort of how those grew, or at least what they're, how they're talked about. But they are driven essentially by profits, not sharing in terms of reciprocity being the fundamental aspect.
What role do you think trust plays in the sharing economy?
Trust is the number one most studied aspect of the sharing economy by social researchers. So we talk about something called generalized trust. This is that we as members of society trust that other members of society are going to follow the rules, regulations, and norms of society. So when we get in our car and we drive around town, we trust that other drivers are going to follow the rules of the road just as we are. And so social interactions like that are governed by a series of laws and regulations and norms, which provides some recourse if a risk doesn't pay off. But digital interactions are a little bit fuzzier. People aren't sure or don't know what the recourse is if the risk doesn't pay off. So I think this is why social researchers consistently find that reputation systems online are important for creating accountability in a way, so that users can vouch for one another through ratings or through reviews or by describing their experiences.
And do we have any reason to believe that people are more trusting now than in years past? Or have the ways that we develop trust, have they changed in the internet age?
It's not that trust has changed, but the mechanisms that help generate trust have changed. So historically, sharing was a community or kinship-based practice, and well-established social relationships were the basis for trust. If you did something to create distrust, then everyone in your community knew about it the same day. Mm. But reputation systems online, as I said, are designed to create accountability in a similar way. So people, you know, write reviews and ratings and so forth. Some studies suggest that this information might not be very reliable, but it is what people rely on when they are seeking out opportunities to share cars or houses or whatever the case may be.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we're talking with Dr. Kimberly Cressup, visiting lecturer at the Department of Sociology at the University of Pittsburgh, looking at the sharing economy. We might assume that people who use some of these sharing resources are trying to save money. Is that it, or are people looking for something else here?
Well, people are always trying to save money. People love bargains across the board. But people are definitely looking for convenience is the number one thing people are looking for here. And people are looking for unique experiences. So one of the most surprising findings, I think, in sociology about this is that users who are part of the sharing economy aren't sharing because they need to, but because they want to, because having a unique experience or an authentic, in quotation marks, experience is important to them.
Who tends to be the users of these sharing platforms? We would assume it's young people, right?
Yeah.
And if so, why is that?
Yes. Roughly half of users are 18 to 34 years old. It's roughly 50-50 between women and men, so gender doesn't seem to play a role here. Most participation happens in urban centers, also not surprising. But also, as I said, the surprising finding is that sharers are twice as likely as non-sharers to have incomes over $100,000. So again, it's not about needing these services, but about wanting unique or authentic experiences. And there is some research that suggests actually that older people, people over 35 or over 55, are not less trusting than younger people. They're actually more trusting. They have more life experience and so forth to draw on and feel they're better equipped to make decisions in potentially risky situations than young folks.
It seems like people view these different experiences in the sharing economy as an alternative or a way of rejecting something. So to paraphrase the famous Marlon Brando movie in the 50s, what are they rebelling against?
Yeah, well, again, this depends on what you're talking about. Certainly some people see using services like Uber or Airbnb as sticking it to the hotel industry or the rental car industry, right? But in fact, Airbnb is a $10 billion a year company. Uber is $40 billion a year. So they're not really sticking it to the corporations as much as they might think they are. But again, it's a mixed bag. Things like couch surfing, for example, people might be having more meaningful interactions and meeting more different kinds of people. So people are rebelling against conformity, I would say, in sort of impersonal exchanges that they see through chains and so forth. But again,
they want something that has more accountability.
Maybe not accountability, but maybe more meaning, something that stems from a more meaningful kind of social interaction, I think is what people are looking for. And so, as I said, though, that's not always the case. That's the ideal. But in fact, most Uber passengers may not even speak to their driver, or Airbnb guests may never see their host, even though that's what they're hoping for.
Dr. Kimberly Cressip is a visiting lecturer in the Department of Sociology at the University of Pittsburgh, joining us to look at the sharing economy. Dr. Cressip, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Coming up, how is the sharing economy being used in Pittsburgh?
You know, I want to get out of the house. I want to hang out with my friends again, but there's poop on my shirt, and I don't want to buy a bunch of the new clothes.
More Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. How is the sharing economy being used in Pittsburgh? We're continuing our look at the sharing economy and the reasons people have for participating.
My name is Bruce Chan, and I am a member of Couchsurfing as well as the Three Rivers Time Bank. And with Couchsurfing, I used it here in Pittsburgh back in April of last year, of 2014, when I was first trying to move here. I was checking out universities. I got to CMU. Never been to Pittsburgh, though. So went to Couchsurfing, which is all online, and was looking for a host. And so I typed in the keyword. I think I typed in, like, bicycle. And the first person, the profile that came up, was a gentleman named Adam. And his profile was amazing. It said, I think the first sentences was, I love Pittsburgh, or I love the city, and I love to explore. I love to show people who are from out of town how great Pittsburgh was. And I was like, I need to stay with this guy. So he picked me up, and the next day he took me on a bike ride around the entire city, along the rivers, through Bloomfield to CMU to Oakland. And I instantly fell in love with Pittsburgh. I was like, I have to move here. You know, even if it's not for school or whatever, I just have to move here. The whole thing about it was that I didn't know him. You know, he didn't know me, but just through trust and just through, like, his profile, basically, and all the reviews he got, too, I was like, great guy. We gotta do this. After 3 days, I left and actually went to Philly to go check out a program there. Didn't really fall quite in love with Philly as much. And I was like, I have to come back to Pittsburgh. So moved here in June and have actually been hanging out with Adam a lot because, you know, through this exchange we had through the Couchsurfing website, we basically were like, buddies, you know. So he's been a great guy, a great resource, a great way to meet other people, especially in Pittsburgh where it's so small. And I've met so many great people through him. And that's all through this little website called Couchsurfing. Getting into something like this, you know, that first jump is really daunting for a lot of people because of issues of trust, you know, things of like, oh yeah, does this website work? Are these people actually legitimate? Or are they actually like running a hostel and not really saying anything about the payment? The first jump is really scary. But I think once you get into it, I think that trust thing, it just kind of kicks in. You're like, okay, it's really about the interaction with people. And you kind of see the selflessness, you know, of people just wanting to share. You know, that's why I think when you think of sharing economy, it really comes down to things more like time banking, sharing economy, or just, you know, neighbors watching each other's kids or something like that, as opposed to the sharing economy, which includes, people think it includes like Uber or Lyft. It's like, yeah, it does, but that includes money. So it's kind of distorts the trust aspect, the human interaction aspect of it. For me, the fact that there isn't money definitely does change it for a good thing, because then you're more focused on the person. And for me, that's why personally I do it. So it's like it's a totally different way of thinking how people interact when it's not a money-based kind of exchange. It's a human interaction experience. Time banking is a it's a concept that's been around for a while, and it's not just here in America. It's actually an international kind of movement, if you will. And what it is essentially time banking. So instead of – it's banking but with time. So instead of using money as currency, we use time as currency. So you earn time, and then you can spend time. And the general equivalent is that 1 hour of time equals one time dollar. And that, though, really isn't the point. It's kind of like couch surfing, and the fact that really what it's trying to do is shift your idea of economy and exchanges from less of money and worth to more of the exchange. So one example people always say is, you know, why do doctors, an hour of a doctor or a lawyer's time, why is that worth more than an hour of a plumber's, you know, time or a mechanic's time? It really is looking at the economy more as a skill and making people, you know, neighborhoods, people, communities, make them, everyone feel worthy of something, that what they're contributing, whether you are providing something that has required you to get a PhD, like a lawyer or something, or whether you're just someone who truly just wants to help your neighbor, give them some sugar, you know, or give them some flour. Like, it's all worth something in a community sense. And so if you look at it from more of a logistic standpoint, yeah, it's 1 hour equals one time dollar. You earn that, and you could take that and go spend it somewhere else. So an example is like if you need your curtains hemmed, you know, you just bought new curtains. You're like, oh, I don't have a sewing machine, nor do I know how to actually sew. Let me go onto the Time Bank website. The one in Pittsburgh is the Three Reverse Time Bank. Go onto there, look up something, look up maybe sewing, and you might find someone who actually does that skill. Talk to them, be like, hey, I need my curtains hemmed. I'll give you a time dollar, one time dollar if you spend an hour. If you spend 2 hours, I'll give you time dollars. And then if they do it for you, you give them time down and they can spend on something else. Maybe they need their car fixed, their bicycle chain fixed or something. They can go on their on the website to see if someone else offers that skill. And the great thing that I love about time banking, you're encouraged to go into debt. Because if you go into debt, that means someone else has gotten time. So there's no time bank police. You know, there's no creditors coming after you or anything like that. They actually encourage you to go negative, because someone else then is going positive, and that means the system is going. People's skills are being used. People are feeling like they're worth something. And that really is what the time bank sharing economy really is about. That is what these things, these sharing economy systems are trying to do. It's to kind of get us back to like the neighborhood, to the neighbor feel, the community feel. And I think in a place like Pittsburgh, where it's so small, it's so great, it's so local, you have these great neighborhoods, that's why I think this city has the potential to really clinch on or really get into that sharing economy.
My full name is Andrea Joy Slack Wetherald. And my title for Share Closet was founder and CEO. It was designed to be a platform, web-based and mobile-based, that would allow friends to connect through sharing their clothing, shoes, and accessories with each other. The idea was really born out of the culture that I experienced when I was traveling abroad in college to Botswana. We stayed in a small village called Pitsang, and I was absolutely blown away and so inspired by the sense of community that Pitsangers had with each other. And as I was reflecting on how they were able to create this community that was so loving and so trusting, I kind of narrowed it down to three key things, which was that in their culture, there are not mirrors, there are not clocks, and there are not doors. And so if your neighbor is away and you have guests, you can just walk into their house and grab a mattress or grab blankets. And it's just not a deal. That's just how it works in their community. And I know that that sort of thing isn't easy to replicate or even necessary to replicate in our culture fully. But I do think that Share CrossFit can be kind of an interesting invitation to this open lifestyle of really being in community with the people around you by willingness to share your things. And I truly believe that sharing connects you to your friends in a really special way. So things have actually been halted for Share CrossFit, and there isn't actually something up and running right now. But for now, Sarah is my co-founder and dear friend, we just needed to kind of take a break and regroup, and we're both at jobs that we love and just kind of taking a break from it for now. I was really surprised as we kind of started pitching this idea around college campuses or just at different startup events. There were certain groups of people that we were expecting to really latch on to this idea who didn't, and then other people that we weren't expecting to latch on to this idea who really did. And I think the best example of that is that, you know, originally we were imagining that, you know, we would pitch to sororities and we would pitch to, you know, college students in particular, and that's where we would roll this out. And what we found was that, you know, people who are 18, 19 are kind of attached to their stuff in a way that people in their 30s aren't. And just based on the feedback that we got, so that was something that we weren't really expecting. And as I said earlier, the fact that we had people who were young moms reaching out to us and being like, this is what I want. You know, I want to get out of the house. I want to hang out with my friends again, but there's poop on my shirt and I don't want to buy a bunch of, you know, clean. I don't want to buy a bunch of new clothes only for my baby to ruin them. So I am very interested in the idea of sharing, the idea of borrowing rather than buying new things. As we kind of tested this idea out, we did find that people were willing to send their things and even ship them. I mean, that was another thing, is that when we tested this idea out, people were even willing to go to the expense of shipping things to their friends, even including little notes of encouragement like, you know, this is my lucky necklace and I hope that you wear it and you're going to do great in your job interview, or that sort of thing. So it's a very supportive environment of people wanting to encourage each other through sharing their things. You know, when someone asks you for clothing, or when they ask you to borrow something around the time of a special event, around the time of their sister's wedding, or around the time of a graduation, or maybe even a funeral, or, you know, like a big life event, a big job interview or something, that's a really vulnerable moment, you know? And I love the idea of Share CrossFit sitting at this cross section of times when we're vulnerable or times when something exciting is happening, and giving us a reason to have FaceTime or a conversation with our friends. At least from the user feedback that we've gotten, is something that people really miss after college is those frequent conversations that you're having because you're all living in such close proximity. I do think that people just genuinely want to be connected with other people, and that Share CrossFit is sort of providing a venue for that. As far as whether or not I think that as a culture we're leaning towards being open, when it comes to what kind of people are open to doing this sort of thing, what kind of people want to share and are willing to share and add, you know, personal touches even to that process, I think that it's people who are we-oriented rather than me-oriented. People who view stuff as just a resource and are kind of focused on what can I do to contribute to my group of friends or to my community. And I think that people who are asking those kinds of questions and are truly deeply reflecting on how can I be connected, you know, are going to be the ones that are interested in doing this and willing to do this. It's not for everyone, and that's okay. But I truly believe that we are hardwired to look for and seek out connection with other people. I do not believe that we are lonely soldiers meant to traverse in solitude through this life. I think that we want to do this with people, you know, and really be connected to other people.
I'm Frank Batista, and I host people at my house through Airbnb. It provides an opportunity for people to find a place to stay in a city that they're visiting. It gives what I would say a more real experience, a local experience, as opposed to the sterility of a hotel. Not that that is a bad thing. Some people really enjoy that. Depending on your host, you know, and how much contact you have with them and where they're located, you get to interact with somebody who is local to the place you're staying. You get the opportunity to hear about their lives, get to exchange stories. And in a non-professional setting, you're not dealing with staff at a hotel who are your servants, per se, during that time. And it's just more real. We stayed in New York for our first Airbnb experience, and it was great. We stayed on a houseboat in Brooklyn for a ridiculously low amount of money to stay in New York City, and it was a very real experience. The host was actually an NYPD detective who kept the houseboat for, you know, his times that he had to stay in the city. He did not live in the city. And I got to interact with houseboat community on the docks. It was really interesting. And we really enjoyed it. He was really nice. And we didn't know what to expect, which was part of the fun as well. Well, we don't consider it a business. We decided to host when a friend of ours, who one of our friends that we had staying in our house, he wanted to take a 3-month tour of Europe. So the space was open, but he did want to return. And we said, hey, we've stayed in places using this thing. Do you mind if we use your stuff as furniture and allow people to stay here? And, you know, the apartment will be waiting for you when you get back. He said that was fine. We had a really enjoyable experience. Our first guest was someone who was touring with Lion King, and we got to hang out with them and hear about theater life and just enjoy that experience. And, you know, giving them a home, you know, in Pittsburgh, not just a room. One of our favorite experiences was a gentleman who was here from Copenhagen, and, you know, got to ride bikes around the city with him. He would come up every night and knock on the door very lightly at 8 p.m. and come in and have a drink or a coffee, and we'd, you know, talk about the day and, you know, had him over for dinner. And, you know, we've really appreciated getting to meet people from all around the world. We have 2 children, and it's been exciting for them to get to meet a lot of different people, a lot of different experiences. And, yeah, we like our life, and it's nice to get to share it. We list our space as a more than good space in a great location. You know, we're very honest about what it is and what it isn't. And we tell people we're happy to spend time with you or leave you entirely alone to have your own adventure. But, you know, we do like to at least get to cross paths in the hallway and say hi and know who's sharing the house with us. The security parameters that are set up for you are great. You can engage with those as much or as little as you want. And, you know, we have offered our guests a pretty fleshed out profile of ourselves. If guests approach us without a fleshed out profile, we ask them for that because we've offered it ourselves. And the fact that there is opportunity for communication prior to with your guest on, you know, sometimes a really, really friendly level, as opposed to just a VRBO where you send in a request and, you know, you're booked. Also, we ask our guests questions, ask them how we can tailor the space to their needs while they're here. We ask them what they like. You know, we ask them if they need any recommendations, and let them know that we're there for them. And Airbnb has set up a template, a space to discuss how to do that, how to be a good host, how to be a good guest. They make everything very easy. All the unfun parts, like the money and those things are peripheral to the actual Airbnb experience. We're really thankful for our guests because they are helping us to live in our house. It's greatly appreciated. Thank you, guests, past, present, and future. But Airbnb has done such a good job of their template just really kind of like makes the money part secondary to the human aspect of it. Yeah, and I would say there are difficulties because, you know, when we first signed on to Airbnb to host, I think there were less than 100 listings in Pittsburgh. And I believe there's over – I haven't checked recently, but the last I checked, which was a year after we signed on, there were over 400. So that was a lot of growth in that time. Part of the experience being great is that, we have one space. We are happy to interact with our people, and we're not just looking to make a buck off of it. The little annoyances kind of go away when there's a relationship there. No, I've never been nervous, and I've heard the horror stories that show up on like HuffPost and whatnot. And I heard a horror story just recently, one person removed, but. You know, again, the security measures that they do have in place are verifications, which I think there are 5+ verifications that you can fill out as to a person's identity. You can ask your guests to fill out a profile. You can ask your guests for a deposit, which we don't do, but, you know, just make sure that they're in. Again, communication is key. The more communication beforehand is what makes us feel more secure. And I wouldn't do this if I didn't feel safe, as we do have kids in our house and a dog. But also, Airbnb does offer insurance to their hosts at no extra charge, which is a really nice peace of mind. We've never been approached by anyone that I would consider creepy. So we do not say yes to all of them. We have rejected some, yeah. And generally, it'll be like, it'll either be people that haven't offered enough information beforehand or that, you know, you just kind of get the vibe that, like, you're here to have a party. We're not into that. You know, we've had people say that they're coming in town for a concert on a certain night, and not to profile, but I've looked and seen what concerts are playing that night, and they're like, oh, you're coming here with the maximum amount of people that we allow for a concert that certain night. I just say, hey, you know, our rules are that we ask that you be respectful of our home and the other people that live here, as we do have another tenant. Do you think that will be a problem? The nice thing is we've actually had a few people be very honest, be like, actually, we are planning on being out pretty late and having a good time, quotation marks. And it's been nice that they've kind of weeded themselves out. For us, we get to meet people that we wouldn't otherwise meet. And, you know, we get to show off our city to them that we really like living in. The other nice thing is that we get to find out things about our city that we didn't know and get other perspectives on it, which has been great. I love that we get to host people from Australia, Europe, China, South America, everywhere. And, you know, we get all these different viewpoints of the place that we live. And obviously all these people think differently as well. Our kids get to interact with these people. So it's opening up their world a little bit more to them. And obviously there is a financial benefit as well. And hopefully our guests, you know, have a great experience. We really like getting to facilitate that.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This hour we've been taking a look at the sharing economy. And here with another take on this economic phenomenon is Marty McGough, Vice President for Market Insights at Campos Research Strategy. Marty McGough, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Oh, great. Great to be here.
As we mentioned in the introduction, we've been looking at the sharing economy and have talked with participants here in Pittsburgh. Is there more to the sharing economy than people selling personal services to others?
Yeah, there sure is. One really interesting element is people sharing passwords to online streaming sites such as Hulu, HBO Go, Netflix. And in some ways, what's most interesting about this sharing of passwords, in many ways kind of under the table sharing of passwords, is it's this element that's been most instrumental in moving the sharing economy into the subscription economy.
And we've invited you in to tell us about something called the subscription economy. Mm-hmm. So let's get into that. How is it different from the sharing economy?
Oh, just to start off, I use a simple example. Just something called HBO Now, which just recently came out. They're an early adopter of this new subscription economy. People were already sharing HBO logins and kind of stealing them and using them and dispersing them to each other. HBO let people get kind of hooked on the shows, then released an app-only, subscription-only streaming service for their channel. And they kicked it off in the weekend of Game of Thrones, new season that started, and it worked beautifully. So businesses are now moving towards structuring their products and services on a subscription basis.
So how far along are we to a subscription economy?
We're getting pretty far along. Actually, businesses are selling subscriptions now to all sorts of items, ranging from razors to toothbrushes, even genome or DNA sequencing you can get on a subscription basis. You know, as a consumer, we're slowly being forced into becoming subscribers. There's even a company called Zora. They sell software that actually helps companies move towards subscription-based revenue models and become a subscription company.
So what advice would you give Pittsburgh businesses to make the most of the sharing or subscription economy?
Yeah, one of the most important things is you got to find a way to design plans that allow for multiple profiles or users on one subscription. So many things now are being shared and used, from cars to vacations to where you go to stay, whatever the case may be. Even tools, even people want to get a certain kind of a saw they're only going to use once or twice. And businesses are starting to look at their goods and services and say, how do we build a model where we get multiple people to subscribe, sell it a little bit of a less, and then sell it on that model? That's what a lot are doing. Another thing is they're setting up kind of shared customer networks of consumers based on needs. So if people are into home remodeling, a service company will offer different things you use for home remodeling that you subscribe to a service and you can use any of them over a period of time. Rather than me going out and buying a saw, buying a hammer, buying all these different things, I subscribe to a service, I get which one I need at a time for a certain price. I'm a subscriber, I pay one price less than if I bought all the goods themselves. But any goods or services could be used in that kind of format.
And Marty, what is the future of the subscription sharing economy?
By next year, like Fortune magazine had a really interesting article that they said by next year, over 35% of global 2,000 companies will generate revenue from subscriptions. That's up 5% from just 10 years ago. That's a sevenfold increase. And over half of all leading global companies in the top 1,000 companies in the process of changing the way they deliver goods and services to go to a subscription model. So we're actually in the early adopter phase, but all companies are starting to move and the economy is starting to move in that direction.
Any other stats you want to share with us?
No, but the one stat I was looking for in Pittsburgh is, and this is just an anecdotal one by looking through business directories and going online, and I would estimate about 1 in 5 companies in Pittsburgh are now selling subscriptions that weren't 10 years ago, and that's a substantial amount.
Marty McGuff is a vice president for market insights at Campos Research Strategy. Thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Okay, thanks for your time. I enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. If you missed any portion of the program or would like to revisit past segments, you can go to our website at wesa.fm. Until next time, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.